Hello everybody, and welcome to the second installment of the BPSA podcast. This time around, we will be discussing smart contracts and alternatives to Ethereum. As many people know, smart contracts have become not just extremely popular, but also very important for the growth of cryptocurrency and blockchain space. Now, today with us, we have some very special guests. First of all, I want to welcome Nutella Lika from the Tokel Platform Project. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I look forward to this discussion.
Brilliant. I would also like to welcome Ohager from the Signum Project. Welcome.
Yeah, welcome. Nice to be here. So I'm keen to see what we're talking about. It will be very interesting.
Last but not least, I want to Welcome Grey Wolf from the TN Network and Polarity Exchange. Hi there.
Hey, everyone. Happy to be here today. Excited to talk about technology.
So we're here to discuss smart contracts, and this is the first part of the second installment of the BPSA podcast. So our discussion topic today is smart contracts and what are the alternatives to Ethereum. But to set the tone and to explain to people a little bit, you know, what we're talking about, Grey Wolf, would you like to get us going with what you know, like a simple explanation of smart contracts?
Sure, I'd be more than happy to discuss kind of a broad overview of what smart contracts are. The easiest way to think about a smart contract is, if anyone's familiar, back in the day when people used to want to create a program, they would put it on a CD-ROM, you know, and then they would sell the CD-ROM, and CD-ROM would have security features like a CD key, you know, a serial number, to validate that, you know, you owned it and it was yours. In the future, where we, you know, live today, we now have software called smart contracts. And instead of using a serial number, what's happened is we've evolved software to run on blockchains. And what that means is that people can publish software content onto a blockchain, like they're distributing a CD-ROM, and the CD key to use that software is actually blockchain gas. So for a quick example, with familiar things people know, if you were to look at Ethereum, Uniswap is a smart contract, and the smart contract has a bunch of software rules about how you can pool assets together to earn fees. And then for other users, it has rules for them to come and swap currencies through this smart contract. And so ultimately, the experience of what you get is a piece of software that can be accessed from any internet-connected device that gives you services that don't rely on a website to operate, so you're always able to access them immutably.
I mean, if you're just an average Joe, you'd think, you know, we have contracts right now. You know, there are contracts, you know, being signed between companies, you know, we will do this, you will do that. There are some terms, we sign the contract, that's it. What's the difference between that, you know, traditional old system and what we now call smart contracts? So what a smart contract can do that a normal contract can't?
Well, the difference is that a normal contract that's drafted between two companies is usually a formal process that takes a considerable amount of time, and it's usually backed by processes of paper management. Where in the example of smart contract, you have a company that can publish this piece of software, and it can be run by anyone on the planet. And there's no actual restrictions on who can use this software. Whereas in the traditional world, say that you are in a foreign country and this foreign country doesn't have the best relations with the US. So for example, you'd be unable to get business advantages. Like you'd be unable to use Coinbase. You'd be unable to access Kraken, for example. Where with smart contracts, anyone on the planet can access the software, and it doesn't matter who you are.
So, Ohagir, would you agree with this definition of smart contracts? And is there sort of any particular real-life examples we can mention that, you know, smart contracts are now solving issues, you know, that industries had in the past in a better way?
I think, yeah, what does... taught by Grey Wolf is totally correct. I would go a step back and try to explain this if it like my mother-in-law. And saying like I very like this the thing with the immutable CD-ROM, which is once is recorded then you cannot change it and the thing. When I try to explain what smart contracts are, there is kind of things that I say is like, imagine you have a program, a small program that has is distributed over the world. This is very important. It means like I can access this anywhere. It's not hosted on a certain server. So I need to explain my mother-in-law what a server is, but we assume that our audience knows that. And then the code that's running there can be run on every site and it's kind of synced. So it's a huge network of the same code running on different nodes.
So you were saying how the smart contract.
Yeah, there's something very important. Yeah, there's something very important on that. And because we have this running on every node, it's transparent theoretically. So people who are able to read code could do that. So it's in contracts between companies, for example, they're not transparent or in public. I think this is something important. And once the contract is installed, it runs. And there is no room for interpretation. So it's a trustless system. That means like if I install the contract, I know my trading partner must not be known by me. While, for example, company contracts are related on trust, I have to trust my trading partner, my partner, to say like, okay, we have this paragraph in our contract and we agree on that. And then we trust each other that we all will fulfill the contract. And the smart contract is a little bit more hard on that and says, like, if we agree on that once we install the contract, so we develop the contract, we formalize the contract, put this on the blockchain, run it everywhere, and then there is no way back. It's like the contract runs, and it has to run. And this is interesting, especially if we start to transfer values, money, within contracts, because we can rely on the formalism which is behind the contract and say like when certain conditions are met the contract triggers. And I think the trustless thing is something very important to mention in this scenario here.
Everybody is talking about trustless, you know, this is like a keyword that's been throwing around, you know, left, right and center. Nutella Lika, why is you know, why is this element of blockchain so important, you know, to have like technology which is trustless?
Yeah, so blockchain is like geographic agnostic. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are, what you've done previously, like anybody can access the blockchain features. And for that reason, you need a trustless mechanism in order to, you know, exchange with somebody else. Like you're not meeting up with somebody in person, and you're not assessing whether they're whether you can trust them during your trade or exchange or whatever you're doing. And the same goes for online. You can't assess everybody that you interact with online. So you need that trustless mechanism where you can, you know, put faith in the cryptography and the technology associated with it so that you can interact and exchange with anybody else without knowing who they are, where they are, what they've done, what they're doing, what they'll do in the future. So that's why the trustless component comes into it, because if it was a trusted system, then it would be impossible to use because you don't know who you're interacting with. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Yes. Thank you very much. So this trust element then that exists in smart contracts, how important is that for you, Grey Wolf?
Trust is very important. I mean, it's really the foundation of why everyone's in blockchain, is that you trust the code instead of having to verify what someone has said. One more time, what was the question?
So the question was, you know, do you agree that trust is a critical element in smart contracts, and you know, how do you see this being applied in technologies today? How does it make a difference, the fact that smart contracts can be trusted, well, not blindly, but you know, they can be trusted because they are a specific code, a specific sort of way to program something to ensure that the outcome is guaranteed on both sides. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And really, the reason that they're called trustless is because the source code is publicly published on a blockchain to be audited. And so what that means is that you or other companies can spend money to inspect that code and make sure that that code is as described by the company before anyone actually interfaces with the software. So that's just one level of trustlessness, is the fact that you can verify it. The second level of trustlessness is that it's on a blockchain, and blockchains are sources of truth. So you have those two levels of trustlessness. And like you said, you can't blindly trust. And that really goes back to the fact that the smart contract itself is written by a human, and humans make mistakes. That's just how life is. So before a smart contract kind of receives that trustless status, it usually receives a series of what are called audits by companies who come and they look for security exploits or dangerous outcomes in the code that nobody saw from, you know, looking topically at the smart contract.
Can we? I mean, that's actually really interesting what you just said. I think in very, very important for smart contracts and smart contract functionality. Do we have some favorite examples of what smart contracts can do in real life right now?
Sure, a lot of examples. One of the easy examples is there's this service called Propy, and Propy's been around for a long time. It allows you to digitize your deed for your items onto the blockchain and then sell them in a regulated marketplace. So maybe two to 4 years ago, there was a football stadium sold on this. There's a lot of very rich real estate that's been pushed onto this platform. And what it addresses is the issue of settlement of real estate, which has traditionally been a very long and drawn out process. because of the instant finality of blockchain, when you combine that with a cumbersome process like real estate management or, you know, purchasing and stuff, what you get is a system that improves the experience by 99%. The person is able to make the purchase and the deed is by blockchain recorded as being under the new owner. So the process is complete the second the block confirms on the blockchain. So that's one example. The second example, almost everybody knows, it's called Uniswap. Uniswap basically is a smart contract that aims to do the same functions of a full centralized exchange, but while being a smart contract. So the benefits of that are it creates unfettered trade between peer-to-peer parties. So that's another example. And then there's even a software on Ethereum called the Kleros Court or something. And it actually has litigation held online. So there are people experimenting in all facets of life, attempting to take processes that were inefficient or cumbersome or annoying and simplifying them to blockchain where they can be completed instantly.
Fantastic. Ohagir, do you have any favorite examples of smart contract functionality? And if not by others, by, you know, any of the, you know, of the projects you're involved in?
Oh, yeah, this is a good question. There's something, I mean, when we talk about smart contracts, usually everybody thinks of Ethereum and on gas fee and other things. But I know from our own chain that we have certain features which, for example, Ethereum does not have. For example, we have self-executing contracts. As far as I know, Ethereum doesn't have that. That means that a contract usually must be triggered by some transaction usually. So you send a message or a transaction to a certain contract, and then it starts running. And in our case, it's like we can implement kind of a self-executing loop such that the contract can be laid down asleep and say, like, okay, every 4 hours, I mean, we measure this in blocks, but every 4 blocks and all that, we can execute a certain thing. Of course, there is the limitation of the fees you have to pay for execution. And this is one thing. And another thing is this is one of the main features we have, and this is something that we really like. So I'm sorry, I have my dogs in the background with, like, my puppies are playing around. I'm not sure if you're hearing that.
No problem.
Making some noise. And a use case we have on top of that, for example, is that we're running a lottery. There is another spec which coming into the randomization. We can talk about this probably later because this is something interesting we have to deal with. But the lottery, for example, is an NFT which is self-executing. It's running there. And it makes a draw every 24 hours like that. And I'm not really sure. I don't know exactly Ethereum smart contracts. But as far as I know, they don't have that, for example. And this opens a lot of interesting features you can do on a time-based manner if you have self-executing ones.
Okay.
Wanted to jump in there real quick. I will get into the high technicals, but that is a feature of Ethereum because it's a fully Turing complete language.
You mean Ethereum has this also, self-executing contracts?
Yes. So long as there's gas in the contract, a contract can trigger another contract autonomously.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, yes, but we are not seeing too much of that, are we? So at the moment, the main form of a smart contract that we see is that one that does trigger quite a few, you know, quite a number of transactions. And
Tokel has a Komodo-based technology that is not technically a smart contract, although it could be seen as a smart contract because it is a piece of software on the blockchain. But the underlying blockchain has custom consensus mechanisms that are written into the blockchain itself. And they use what they call smart UTXO, and I think we're getting a little bit heavy in the technicals, but they use smart UTXOs to trigger those smart contracts in a way. So Tockle uses Komodo underlying technology, which is this smart UTXO technology, where you could lock up one tiny little bit of your Tockle and turn that into a token or an NFT. So for each Satoshi of Tockle, it becomes an NFT. And basically what it is it's the, for tokens specifically, the blockchain is indexing that Satoshi and the attached data that you put onto it and says, hey, this is an NFT. So from the user perspective, they see this NFT, but if you deep dive into the weeds, it is a single Satoshi of the Tockle coin that has specific data that you've written onto it on that piece of on that piece of Tockle, and that will be written onto the blockchain forever for anybody to see. So that's a more in-depth look into how Tockle does it.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's great to hear. From your side, Grey Wolf, how does TN approach sort of smart contracts?
So TN is a fork of Waves, and Waves began their journey in 2016. Their goal was scaling first, because one of the largest issues with Ethereum and UTXO chains and a lot of old traditional technology models is that they're all susceptible to what's called MEV, which is minor extracted value. Basically, to summarize what that means, it just means that there's a fee economy. So whoever can pay more than the other person gets their transaction processed first. And that can lead to some pretty sticky situations depending on, you know, how busy that blockchain is, for example. So let's say that your blockchain gets an adoption level of 1 million users, and let's say that a quarter of those users are all trying to use a specific NFT marketplace. Let's say that there's a very popular artist who's only dropping 100 pieces. Well, it could all be launched at a fair time using timestamp, but the fact is that I could come to almost any blockchain and just pay more than everybody else, and I'll just get prioritized in the blocks and I'll take all the NFTs. So Waves saw this issue a long, long, long time ago. And the way that they addressed it was they have their own consensus mechanism, similar to what Tockle was saying, in that it has a smart UTXO system. Every single transaction on the Turtle network gets its own block. And then all those blocks are aggregated into one block at the end of every minute. So it's not susceptible to the same scaling issues, but because of the way that it was implemented, it doesn't have the same so there are trade-offs in the world of security and smart contracts that each blockchain is going to have.
Okay, that's a very, very interesting point you just made there. So you said that it has sort of, you know, it has less complexity. Does less complexity mean higher security?
Yes, and that was the entire intention, was that there are two common languages in smart contracts, and we'll just discuss Ethereum, for example, as this is kind of the benchmark. Ethereum is what's called Turing complete. Turing complete is a way to describe a system that's able to run full complex code. So you could run Python on Ethereum, for example, which is very expressive. You can make up any function you want, right? Anything you can imagine, you can write and you can run it. Now, that leads to a lot of danger. In the world of smart contracts, I'm sure everyone here has heard of the hacks that have happened. There's almost a cumulative of about $800 billion plus dollars that have been hacked from smart contracts since has begun to exist.
That is insane. That is an insane number.
One of the most notorious smart contract hacks was in the beginning of Ethereum. It was one of the first smart contracts. It was called the DAO. Everyone here should remember the DAO. When that contract was exploited, it actually caused Ethereum to be split into two chains, Ethereum Classic and then regular Ethereum, where they rolled back the blockchain a bit so they could fix the hack that had happened. So, that's just a little example of how smart contracts can go wrong. And in the process of learning all these things, one core things that the Waves devs kind of did was they said, hey, we'd like to make an environment that's completely safe for people to work inside of. And so they made the language non-Turing complete. So while it doesn't have the same freedoms as Ethereum, almost anybody can write smart contracts for Turtle Network and have an extremely high level of security. Because the only thing that can go wrong is you don't give the correct permissions to the smart contract. That's it.
Oh, wow. So that again, is very, very interesting and useful information, I think, for everybody to take into consideration. Now, one big question is, can smart contracts be trusted? And before everybody jumps in and says, if they can be trusted and how their project, is approaching, this trust, my question to all of you is, how can we trust something when we don't understand it? And I'm assuming that we don't have any, specialist cryptographers here. I mean, does anybody understand this cryptographic language that all these blockchains are sort of built with? And how can we trust them? And how does your project approach, trust?
Is it okay if I jump in real quick?
Sure.
For me, I can personally say that I'm not an engineer or scientist. So when it comes down to the math behind these systems, I can't say that I could on a napkin write out the answer to any of these complex algorithms. But what I can say is that when it comes to trust, you have a couple things. The first thing is that you can view the source code. And the second thing is that you can hire an audit. So just because you can't read the smart contract doesn't mean that we can't find someone who can, right? And so how, Turtle Network deals with smart contracts is that we find someone who understands the language enough that they can revise or review the smart contract and look for errors before it's used or approved. Personally, as someone who uses smart contracts on Ethereum, I don't know Solidity, but what I do is I look to see if the project has been audited by a professional security company first. If it's been audited and it says it's safe, the likelihood is that it's safe. But, at the end of the day, I would say unless you wrote the smart contract yourself, you should always only put in what you can afford to lose, because cryptocurrency is still in its infancy. It's really very much like the early dial-up days of the internet. So just exercise caution and always look for, positive signs of approval from the community before interacting with a piece of software.
I'll piggyback on that. I think it's important for people to use a bit of common sense as well. So if the smart contract or, the process that you're looking to use is being used constantly by a lot of people, and you can validate that, and you only need to use it once for one thing, then you don't necessarily have to go into depth and look into, the nitty-gritty of the smart contract. Your trust then becomes the fact that you're seeing it occur, and you only have to use it once for a small amount of funds or for one, implementation of whatever it is. if you're going to then implement that into your business processes or your project, that's when you would then allocate more time to looking into the nitty-gritty of it, or looking into the you know, the weeds behind it, or getting somebody to actually validate it for you or your project. The way Tockle handles that is that we have a partnership with the Komodo team, and the Komodo team have some extremely smart developers that self-review the, for lack of a better term, the smart contracts, or the custom consensus mechanisms that they call Antara modules. And they also have JL777, who's an incredibly smart developer that is part of that process as well. So unlike, you know, the Solidity-based smart contracts, there aren't too many UTXO-based custom consensus mechanisms out there at the moment. So there hasn't been a huge need for these validations or these reviews of the custom consensus mechanisms yet. But in the future, when there are more and there's a lot of different ones out there and a lot of different people creating them, then that's definitely going to be a necessity.
Yeah, I think if we talk about the trust, and this was something that Grey Wolf said already, is that in the end, it's a human who writes the contract at this time. Probably in the future, we will have some AI-supported things. From my perspective, is a good thing is that it's transparent and auditable. But you need experts to do that. So, and even the code that is on chain needs to be, at least on our part, but it's a bytecode, and I think most engines work the way also. So you need to start already thinking like, okay, I have my high-level source code, which is being compiled down to something like a bytecode that can be executed by the virtual machine. So you need to have a match on that. I was thinking recently about that. There are kind of layers of problems, technical problems. I mean, we have the human factor. It's okay. And the technical things is like exploits or errors in the programs itself. It can be the virtual machine itself that can be exploited, for example. It can be the intermediate language or the compiler, which introduces errors, which can be exploited also. And of course, the programming errors you as a normal developer do. So no developer makes error-free code. There's especially when we are talking about huge values, and we saw that all these losses in the exploits and in errors in the smart contracts. This is very difficult. So I think we are still in a very early stage, and there needs to be something like formal verification of code and all this stuff. This is something I started to look into, but it's really too high for me to be honest. And this is something that needs to be much more major, I think so. And only having reviews or peer reviews of the smart contracts, which is the first step, but I think this should be kind of automated. And there must be patterns, and probably in the future that will be AI supported, that such flaws and problems can be detected before it's being deployed. Because once it's deployed, then it's there, and then there's no way back. So there's much work in front of us, and but it's very interesting and exciting times. And peer review is the first step for sure, yeah, and auditing.
I think it's important for people to understand what you just said there. Once it's deployed, you can't claw it back. You have to actually deploy another smart contract with UTXO-based custom consensus mechanisms. You can indeed hard fork them and change the underlying consensus mechanism, which is a small but mentionable benefit of a UTXO-based smart contract.
And then in the case of Turtle Network, we have the ability for you to publish a smart contract and then overwrite its state as many times as you want. And when you want it to become a permanent software, you basically lock it into the immutable state, at which point it can never be changed again.
Oh, that's cool. And on our side, it would be like you disable the contract. You literally disable it, and then you will put a new version on that. So, but the problem is it's a new address and all the things. So we, from our current state, we have to run this on a testnet and staging environment, and then We have emulators to run them on low run, I mean locally on the machine. But in our case, it's like it's on the chain. And so, but you can deactivate the contract. So if you see there's kind of problem, you can save this and record that. But it should be always be in mind that there must be changes on software. And I think this is a drawback probably on our system. I'm not sure. Because it's different from making software like for the normal web and cloud stuff where you can just like deploy over it and then fixing the bugs over a period of time.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that you bring that up because at least for how the way that me and some of the community members, we've been developing contracts, we do it as module upgrades. So, for example, like there's this social DAO that we're working on, and it began as like just two functions, minting and burning. And we, over time, introduced two new functions and a admin key to add USDT to the pool and stuff. But yeah, it is interesting when you're mentioning the process of developing is usually one that takes a lot of time and code's usually not done in its first revision. So yeah, that's a very interesting point that you brought up.
Thank you very much, all of you, for you know really going at this point of you know trust in smart contracts. Now, I want to move to you know a next point, which is the gas fees. I mean, this was mentioned briefly before, but I mean, one of the issues with traditional banking was the fact that you know. Banks used to charge fees, and nobody liked that. And you know, when banks abolished fees, you know, a lot of people really embraced that. And then when blockchain started, suddenly these transaction fees crept back in. So, what exactly are gas fees? Why do they exist? And what have you done in your projects to solve, you know, the gigantic issue of these ultra-expensive Ethereum gas fees?
Just so I can give everyone a quick explanation of, like, what is gas, the best explanation, I'll give two comparisons to make it really, really easy. It's called gas, so we'll start with a car. You can think of a blockchain as a car, and it's always driving somewhere. You can just think of it driving in a straight line. And let's say you want to get a ride downtown. The only way you're going to do that is if you pay some gas. Pretend we live in a world where instead of paying people dollars, you just pay with the raw resources. So if you want a ride, you better bring the amount of gas you need to get from point A to point B. And so that's really what gas is. And then if you break it down into like a more simple understanding, pretend that, you know, a blockchain's a computer, which it is. And if you want to interact with that computer, you need some credits first. You need some compute credits. And that's what these coins are, is they're compute credits so that you can do an operation. An operation would be, I want to send money to my friend. To do any action with a blockchain, you need to first have some gas credits to pay the blockchain's miners.
Okay, so essentially gas fees are, you know, a form of a transaction fee that goes back to miners, you know, it facilitates on the one hand transactions and on the other hand it rewards miners with percentage of these fees, right?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic.
It is slightly different to a transaction fee though, because it's activating the specific smart contract that you want to engage in. So you have to pay the transaction fee and the gas fee that activates that smart contract that you're using. With UTXO-based smart contracts or custom consensus mechanisms, they don't actually have that gas fee. because it is a consensus mechanism. So the entire blockchain, whether you've activated that software program or not, is underlying in the daemon or in the blockchain that you're running. So you still need the typical transaction fees to go to the miners, but you don't need to activate the actual smart contract itself. So that's a slight difference with UTXO-based smart contracts.
So you're saying the you guys don't have gas fees?
Yeah, that's correct. So you'd still, if you wanted to transact a token, for example, that is using the underlying custom consensus mechanisms on Tockle, but you would just use the typical transaction fee for the blockchain, because what you're doing is you're sending a Satoshi of the Tockle coin itself. So all you need to do is pay for that Satoshi to be transferred to somebody else. Say if I wanted to transfer that Satoshi to yourself, you just pay the transaction fees to the miners. They'll process that transaction. The underlying custom consensus mechanisms know what to do with that Satoshi. And then that Satoshi is now in your hands. For any more intricate smart contracts, for example, where you know that Satoshi might be locked up into an address, basically it requires the whatever consensus mechanisms you put on that Satoshi, it requires those to be fulfilled before it will then unlock it. So all that would then require is a transaction fee for you to interact with it, not necessarily transaction fee and a gas fee to run the smart contract.
Okay, that's becoming a lot clearer in my head now, and I hope to the people listening to us. Oh, Hager, how did Signum go about, you know, eliminating this huge problem of ultra-expensive Ethereum gas fees?
Well, the answer is much simpler in that case. I mean, the execution of, in Signum, it's like the contract itself, or the instruction as part of the contract has fees, but the execution fee is extremely low. And because even the value of Signa, our coin, is low also. So in the end, it's extremely low cost to execute even complex contracts with more than thousands instructions or 10,000 of instructions.
What is going to happen if Signum goes to $3,000 like Ethereum has?
First of all, I will buy an aisle and will live my life there. But on the other hand...
That's one of the best answers today.
Yeah. But no, if that happens, there will be consensus with the entire community to lower the fees somehow. I mean, this will be a kind of a delicate thing, because you need to see that miners want to have their part. And of course, there would be... I don't know, maybe my neighbors on other aisles, I don't know if that's them. But what I mean is we are regulating this on top of that, just that we want to make it, keep it attractive to work on that. I'm not really understanding why Ethereum probably is not lowering the costs, gas fees. Maybe this is out of my scope and my understanding. But I heard of that many people complain that the execution of that contract is too expensive. And so I don't know, maybe it's just like, I don't know why they do that, but I think we would lower that if that we are in $3,000 or something like that. But actually today it's very cheap to run our contracts. It's just a fraction of the Signa.
They're probably not lowering it because it's making the miners a lot of money.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and on the other hand, just like to complete on that, the other thing is, you need to find a balance, because if you have very low contract costs or execution fee costs, you run risk that your chain will be spammed. For example, so if we remember, for example, CryptoKitties was kind of congesting the entire blockchain, and probably this kind of costs can regulate this a little bit and like counterattack probably this kind of spamming contracts or something like that. I mean, I would think twice to spend $25 for an execution, or if I just like 2 cents, then it makes a difference for me.
Nobody would go to the bank, right? Say, I want to send $100 to my friend, and the bank say, I will keep $25 and they'll say, okay. That's just not on, is it?
For sure. And, you know, to jump on and just kind of explain for everyone why fees are the way they are in Ethereum, it just goes back to how the way that the transactions are processed in the UTXO bus. Basically, like, the reason it's so expensive is because people see value in exploiting timing for others. And this is what's called MEV, or minor extracted value. You can look this up. It's a very well explained topic. Basically, it says that if there's value to be extracted by taking advantage of others, then there's value to be extracted and it will be extracted. So the idea is that people trade on Uniswap, right? Well, you can front run other users and you can actually make a profit off of them. So this is a very basic example. And so what happens is, instead of Uniswap costing $5 to use, it's going to cost an average of $25 because there are people that are paying $500 to take advantage of other people. And there are people that are trying to pay $1,000 to take advantage of the people that are taking advantage with $500 of the people that are trying to spend $25. And so you get this scenario where basically the fees keep rising because people keep fighting over priority to access a smart contract.
Why?
And so,
can you explain why that's the case? Like, why do the higher costs get to use the smart contract first?
Because if you pay more, you get a better priority. That's just how blockchains work. You look at Bitcoin, it's the same thing. You make a low priority transaction, you can immediately replace it with a higher one. And which one actually processes? Well, the higher one does, right? So this is the same with the majority of all blockchains that you can set a custom fee for. If you set a higher fee than someone, you get processed first.
Well, that's not very democratic. I mean, if you think about it, if that's the case, then that always favors whales and
correct.
You know, people who accumulate a lot of, you know, a lot of coins. A lot of funds, they have a large portfolio. So that's not very good, is it?
No, definitely isn't.
I'll let you go.
I'll be quick here. So, you know, that's one of the largest issues with just kind of blockchain in general, is that if you haven't structured the UTXO pool properly, people are going to take advantage of other users once the financial opportunity is present. And then you end up in an Ethereum situation, whether you thought you were going to or not. And just so, for example, like TN actually doesn't have to do anything about that, because that was one of the first things that Waves tried to solve, was that no one should get a higher priority than anyone and that everyone's transaction is equal, right? So whatever order the micro blocks appear in, that's the order they're processed.
Yeah,
that sounds really fair.
Thanks for answering that.
Yeah, you just can't pay more than someone. If you pay more than someone, then you just have given the miners more money, but you don't get a boost in priority because that's just not fair. No one should be able to lily pad jump in front of someone else. This isn't Frogger.
Sorry, I keep jumping in there. The reason I ask that is, I guess, maybe a lack of understanding of smart contracts and how they process each time somebody wants to use that smart contract. What actually dictates transacted first? Is it still per block,
or per is block. It
over a period of time?
It's per block. So say within one block time that you have 1,000 people using Uniswap. Who goes first? Well, it starts from the top. And the guy that paid the most, he's got the highest transaction priority in the queue. So his Uniswap TX goes first. And then that's followed by the second guy, followed by the third guy, followed by the fourth guy, followed by the fifth guy.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess it's just like normal transaction fees in the blocks, and once the blocks start to fill up because there's a finite resource there,
exactly, the issue comes back to scaling and the fact that because there are no dynamic blocks on Ethereum or Bitcoin, that there's a finite limit. There's no escaping this. It's like, a city bus only has 40 seats on it, right? So you want to fit other people in there. It just becomes, sardine can. That's what's happened with blockchain is we have, at this point, the technology for most blockchains does not meet the demand of all the people trying to use it currently. And as a result, people are fighting. They say, no, I want my transaction to process first. And so Uniswap goes, well, you can pay the high fee and it'll confirm faster. And so everyone's clicking high fee because they want to confirm right away. And what's the result? Now the express.
Well, one of the biggest problems in the world is the accumulation of wealth to only a few people. And blockchain has come in to solve that, right? By democratizing finance and, by helping people, have their own money, in their own possession and in their own control and, benefiting them in multiple ways. But it sounds here like, smart contracts are hiding a very big threat. And it has become just, instantly now evident to me why so many different projects are trying to build, better smart contract functionalities than what's currently on Ethereum and, Binance Smart Chain, because it seems that this is critical now for the democratization of smart contracts and finance in the future and giving everybody equal chance in this system.
100%.
Yeah. I think what it highlights is that where I think the ecosystem or the crypto ecosystem as a whole is going to go, and it's towards the multi-chain ecosystem where there's application-specific public blockchains for people to use for application-specific reasons. I don't necessarily believe in one chain is going to rule them all because of exactly what we're talking about. How that multi-chain ecosystem is going to interact with each other is going to be incredibly important for usability purpose, as well as giving everybody access to each of those multi-chains. But in my opinion, I think the multi-chain ecosystem is where we're going to head, or where we're going to have to head to. There's going to be different blockchains that have completely different offerings, and just because one blockchain has smart contracts and another has smart contracts doesn't mean they're the same. They can offer different use cases. Yes, you can still create smart contracts on either one of them, but if they focus on doing something quite well, I think that is a useful output.
I just agree plug, totally I guess on that.
Yeah. That's what we're trying to do at Tockle.
Yeah, I think I totally agree on that the evolution is that multi-chaining thing, interop, and then it will be interesting how, for example, incompatible systems can interop, and this is something what we are seeing right now. The first steps are done. We have kind of multi-chain projects already. And even on Signum, we are thinking of kind of that. And I think it's very, very, it's correct that you said like application specific chains. So I think of that like I have my chain, which is configurable in terms of scalability, like throughput or whatever. And for my specific use case, I can tune my chain and make it probably interoperable with the other chain. I mean, it's the best thing when we have the same technology, but we need to think how to do this with others. But this is out of the scope of smart contracts, but they are key piece, I think, in terms of interoperability. This will be interesting. Like Atomic Swap is something which starts making kind of interop already.
I think this was a big realization for me when I was looking at smart contract platforms and smart contract blockchains. And I was looking at all these blockchains and going, well, they all offer smart contracts. Why don't they just use, why don't they just use one chain? And then it dawned on me that that's not the intent and that shouldn't be what we're trying to achieve here. Like We shouldn't be trying to put everything onto one blockchain. Yes, that would be useful because everything's in one spot. But when you think about the technology associated with public blockchain, it doesn't really make sense as a whole. But that's just my two cents.
Okay, to close this amazing discussion, because we're coming up to an hour now, I want you, all of you, to give me, sort of in short, how the world would be right now if instead of Ethereum and Binance Smart Chain, it was your project that was offering the underlying technology to these smart contracts. What would the world look like, let's say, if you know, the Turtle Network was powering Uniswap?
If Turtle Network was powering Uniswap, I think the world would for sure be a much more calm place, because fees would be low for everyone, and you wouldn't have people fighting and front-running each other, and you wouldn't have this battleground, basically. It would just function as intended.
From a Tockle point of view, I think it would be quite different, because we don't necessarily offer what Binance Smart Chain and Ethereum offer in totality. We're really focused on tokens and NFTs and offering solutions for tokens and NFTs themselves. So big picture, you'd be missing out on a lot of technology, but that isn't our focus. If we just look at tokens and NFTs, it would be far more, if people used Tockle instead of Ethereum and Binance Smart Chain, it would be far more inexpensive, it would be far more accessible, and there would be a lot more usability for tokens, not just to own it as a piece of digital ownership, but the usability behind it, because it's inexpensive to use and transact and interact with the blockchain.
Be Signum, there were we lack, for example, the smart contracts. Our engine at this moment, what we're working on, that is like tokenomics and token support. Also, our chain has inbuilt ones, but the smart contracts cannot interact. So we lack this feature. But one is for sure would be much more inexpensive. Another aspect would be we haven't touched that point about the consensus in general. But as we are driven or being a green coin or green platform using a mixture of proof of capacity and proof of stake, it would be much fairer. So that means that whales cannot stake and having control or more control over the chain or more weight on the chain. It would be much more democratic for sure, and even less energy hungry. If I point towards the proof of work things, so energy consumption would be something different and that term.
Sorry, Tim, just to pile on a little bit here, I quickly did the math, because you asked the question earlier about how much smart contracts would cost if your project was the market cap of Ethereum. So Ethereum, when I did this math, was about 228 billion market cap. If Tockle had that market cap, each Tockle would be about $1,150 per Tockle. And each NFT to create would cost roughly 0.000012 of a cent to create. And the transaction fee for actually sending that to somebody would be 11.5 cents.
Well, that's quite revealing, isn't it, as a number? Wow, this is amazing. I think this has been incredible. We touched on quite a lot of different aspects of smart contracts, and at least my personal understanding is far better now of smart contracts, what they do, and also, you know, some very, very key issues that they have, and, you know, how everybody is working to resolve them. I want to really thank our special guest, Nutella Lika from the Tockle Platform Project. I want to thank especially, you know, Grey Wolf from the Turtle Network and Polarity Exchange and the BPSA, and also Ohager for Signum and the BPSA for all coming here today and contributing your thoughts. And I will also like to really thank Cax for helping us to record this session. He's always, you know, working in the background and making things happen. So thank you all for coming today. It has been amazing.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us and coordinating.
Well, thank you very much, guys. Everybody who's listening, don't forget that we're going to follow up with smart contracts, alternatives to Ethereum. So watch out for that one. Thank you very much and have a good day, afternoon or night, wherever you are. Thank you. Bye-bye.